Okay, so tomorrow we have the main topic is ICP-MS theory, so two theory lectures. But hope you will stay awake during those. And I will start with some general course issues and the group work, so something about those first. And some people have been sending me email asking about the exam or the exercises during Friday. So unfortunately, I'm not working on Friday. So if you want to, I forgot to mention this when we started, but I'm working on Mondays to Thursdays until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and on Friday I'm not working. So I'm off work Friday. So if you want to have some answers to the exercises which are returned at the end of the week, I suggest you send them by Thursday midday, so I have time to respond. So sorry for if I haven't responded to your emails in time, but that's the reason why. Actually, the mandatory course content, because there have been some questions about the ICP demonstrations or the lectures. So the lectures themselves are not mandatory. You can come here, watch the recordings anyhow you want. And the ICP demonstrations are not mandatory, but the exercises are. But I haven't required anything that the answer should be perfect. At least you have tried your best. So that's enough. So effort in doing the exercises is required. So, but if you fill in a blank, you haven't even tried, then we need to have some discussion. But some effort is needed in the exercises. Home exam you already did. Everyone has returned it on time, so great. You need to have minimum 50 points to pass. And actually, I have a colleague who is reviewing them. And the group work needs to be done to pass the course. So it's just a pass and fail. The presentation needs to be done and the literature summary needs to be accepted. Yeah. And about the ICP demonstrations, I added one ICP OS demo time into the Moodle. So if you're still looking for a group, there's one. And I also added 5 ICP-MS demonstration times. So these are taught by me because we don't have any other teaching personnel who use the ICP-MS, so I'm the only one. Yes, hopefully I don't get sick during those demonstrations. Otherwise, our time schedule will be quite difficult. Yes. But note that these are not mandatory, but keep in mind that they are very useful if you haven't operated these instruments yourself before. I know some of the students here on the course who routinely use ICP OS, so in that case, it doesn't make any sense to come to the ICP OS demonstration, for instance. So you can consider this yourself. So if you haven't operated either of the instruments yourself, please come to the demonstrations. You will see firsthand. So it's very beneficial in that case. Any questions on the general course issue? Something unclear? Yes, go ahead.
Find out who's in our.
Yes, I will come to that. Actually, almost all of the students have selected your group work topics, so only 3 students haven't. And the capillary electrophoresis here is still available, so those 3 that haven't selected a topic, please go ahead and select your topic so we will have the groups ready. I can actually show you the. I thought that you would see your partners in the model, but I have been told that you don't see it. So I will just quickly show you. I will put in
Can you see it properly? I will put in some kind of list into the Moodle where you can see your group members. But yeah, here are your group members and the topic capillary electrophoresis is still available, which has no students at the moment. And four is the maximum participation number, and some groups have two people still, so there is still availability to choose a topic you want. But in case your group is full, I think you can start contacting each other. In some cases, I think that you don't know each other, but the Moodle, I guess it will show you if you check the participants list. If you check them, you can see their emails at least. In a case that you can't, I don't know if I'm allowed to put your email here because about the current regulations, I don't know if I can do it, so I would have your emails also here that you can contact each other. But yes, I will figure it out and put these, at least your names and topic on some kind of list. And at least one student told me that they are only available on the other seminar day. So if you have some specifications that you want to have your seminar on a specific day of those two that are available, please let me know. I will also put the presentation order in Moodle at the same time as I put these participant names. Yeah. But let's go back to my PowerPoint. Yes. Yeah, then a little bit about the presentation, how to do the presentation and literature summary. So the group work consists of the presentation and a short literature summary. And we want to get to know one technique in specific and present it to other students in the seminar days. So you will only look at one technique, but when you attend the seminars, you will learn about the other techniques also. So there are 10 in total. So although the seminar days are not mandatory, you just need to present your own results, own presentation. But I would suggest that you attend the seminars if you can to both days, because they are very useful to get to know these different kinds of techniques. So you should include the basic principle of the technique and present its applications in practical examples. And I would say that you can focus on the technique, what it can say, contains, how it's operated, and how it's connected to the ICP-MS or ICP-OS, but leave out any ICP-MS or ICP-OS theory because we have already went through that during the course, so it's no need to go through this in detail in your presentation. It takes unnecessary time during your presentation if you go into ICP-OS and ICP-MS theory. But how the specific technique is operating, how it's connected to the ICP instrument, that's important. And about the application, so you can find some scientific articles or similar which are using this technique. And rather than a long list of, I would say, applications that can be used, I would focus, maybe select a few, two to three, or depending on how many students you have in your group, that take a more closer look at some application and present that rather than a long list of, okay, this is used in da 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 da. Because we want to know how it's working and maybe add some
Calibration, how it's calibrated. Can you use normal calibration? Is it quantitative? These are important points to discuss. And if you're using some kind of real life example, how they have calibrated, what kind of validation for the results, or how they are validating the reliability of the results using some kind of reference material, for instance, something like this. I would like to see that. So the presentation time, if you have two people in your group, 10 minutes, three people, 15 minutes, four people, 20 minutes. And a cohesive presentation, and prepare this together and use a PowerPoint template. So I don't want to see if you there's three people in your group that you send me three different PowerPoints, each with 10 slides. Then we are in trouble because we have 15 minutes for your presentation. So make it one cohesive presentation. You can even discuss how long each part takes, so you will reach the time limit that is required. And think about how many slides you have time to cover realistically. Sometimes you get excited and you make more and more slides, and then you don't think about the time restriction here. So because we are having five presentations during one seminar, which is maximum 2 hours, so we don't want to have the time limits exceeding for each presentation, because then we will be overshooting our time. And if I had a two people group and 10 minutes, I would prepare approximately 5 to 7 slides, at least not more than 10. So if you have 1 minute for one slide, that's quite the fast pace even. So I would try to keep the number of slides a little bit down, because this has been a common issue when we have the group works and presentations, that we are overshooting in the time. Okay, then about the literature summary. So I want you to write down the stuff you have in your presentation, just a summary that you will know what is the technique and how it's operating. So a summary of your presentations. And the length should be 2 pages for two people, 3 pages for three people, and so on. Plus the references, they can exceed this limit. And please add how you divided the work during this work. So I have between pairs. I used to have pair work here, but this is a group work now. Some pairs maybe still be there, but divide the work into sections and indicate who has done each section. And if you have some comment that the work has been divided in equally, or you think that you have done more than others or something, there have been problems with the division of work. Of course, try to fix it beforehand. Tell me if someone is not doing anything in your group work. But in case this is the case, still you can always show it here. So please tell who has done what. In the literature summary at the end. And please do not exceed the page limit, because this is a summary. It also there could be lots of interesting issues you want to write about, but this is to summarize this topic, so don't exceed this page limit. Okay. Any questions about this topic? If not, we can move on to today's discussion, ICP-MS theory. So this is the actual topic of today. So we are moving on to the world of ICP-MS, mass spectrometry. So what does this what is the comparison between the two? So we already looked at ICP OS. We have a liquid coming into the plasma and we are getting some emission coming from the plasma. And we are measuring the photons or the electromagnetic radiation that comes from the plasma, which tells us the wavelength, tells us which element is present, and the intensity tells us the concentration when we use a calibration. That's what we have already covered. In ICP-MS, the ICP part is basically the same. The liquid comes into the plasma, but we form ions and we actually determine these ions. So plus one charged ions is what we are measuring with the ICP-MS. And what elements can we measure? They are measured, colored in this periodic table. So pretty much all of the elements of the periodic table, some not available here. One of the lightest or the gas-formed elements, but basically all of the periodic table. And here you can see also the isotopes of these elements. So we can measure each of these isotopes with ICBMS. For some elements, there are several we can choose from, molybdenum, several isotopes. Beryllium is monoisotopic, so some elements are monoisotopic, and we can only measure one element, one isotope in that case. Calcium monoisotopic also. Or are they very, very small? I can't see. Basically, at least, monoisotopic. And the ratio of these isotopes tells us about the sensitivity. So if all we have a monoisotopic element, all of the intensity goes into that one peak, but if we have six isotopes, the intensity is spread across all of these isotopes. So these have less intensity in that case. Okay, but then let's take a look at the how does it work. So we are here having the same things as we had with the ICP-OS. I have some stuff here I want to show you, some nebulizers, some spray chambers, and so on, and the ICP torch. They are pretty much the same as in ICP-OS, but then we go into a different kind of region, because the ICP torch works in normal pressure, in air, and this mass spectrometer operates in vacuum. So we have to move from normal pressure to vacuum. And this is done via the ICP-MS interface. So this is the interface region. And here we have some pumps. Here we have a mechanical pump and some turbo pumps here, which operate the vacuum in the mass spectrometer. I have some nice stuff here. Maybe not fun. Okay. Just going to recap last lecture stuff. So what is happening in the nebulizer? So we are pumping our sample into a nebulizer. We are forming an aerosol. Large droplets are removed in the spray chamber. And in the plasma, sample is dried, vaporized, atomized, and ionized. So that's the sample introduction system. But now I want to show you, because last time this only occurred to me after the, well, I don't need this right now, after the lecture, that I would like to show you some stuff related to the sample introduction system. I have had some figures, of course, but it's always nice to, if you just fastening yourself. So I have some nebulizers here.
Maybe I will show the. I will turn my camera on here so I can show the guys with the recording also. This is what we normally use. This is a nebulizer, chemical nebulizer. This is what we normally use with ICP-OS. This is what I talked about. This is a concentric nebulizer. This gets easily blocked, and this we use for pure samples only. This is the parallel path. I think this is a Miramist nebulizer, so this is a parallel path nebulizer. I can put this into the classroom so you can look at them. Take care with this one because this is glass and this is fragile. So you can take a look at how thin this inner tube is here. It's super, super thin. So you can really see why it's blocking easily. The other ones are those which we use for like dirty samples. But the concentric nebulizer, which has the glass, which is made of glass and has the very narrow inner tube that's very easily blocked. So you can take a look at those. Also, I have a few spray chambers. This is old one, but not so old. This is a spot spray chamber and it has a cross flow nebulizer, yes, it's inside it, so you can see it. But this is made of some kind of ceramic material, so this will actually tolerate if you have HF, hydrochloric acid, and so on. And this is cyclonic spray chamber, and this is made of Teflon, so as you can see, it's white, so this can also tolerate HF if you have in your samples. Some of you have probably been in the ICP-OS demonstration already, so you have probably seen the glass cyclonic spray chamber. So that's what we are using in that in the ICP-OS lab currently. Well, that's a little bit about the sample introduction and the plasma processes. Okay, then we have the interface, as I mentioned. Then we are I'll stop the video. My clicker wasn't working. Okay, so the ion beam that comes from the plasma is directed through cones. So we have cones here, and we are moving to vacuum. And using ion optics, we have ion optics here. We are separating neutrals and photons using ion optics. So we don't want any neutral or photons in our mass separation device. It will just dirty it up, so we want to get rid of them. So that's what's happening in the interface and ion optics. Then we have a mass spectrometer, so we are separating the ions from each other using this mass to charge ratio, and ions are then directed to the detector, and ions are counted using this ion count is transferred into an electronic signal. Yeah, that's basically it in a short summary. But then we can take a closer look at these each specific points. Yeah, as I mentioned, this is similar to ICP-OS, so the sample introduction and the plasma are working in a similar manner.
Yeah, I also mentioned this. But the difference between ICP-OS and ICP-MS is that the plasma properties are now optimized. So we want to maximize ionization efficiency because we want to have ions, which we are determining using the mass separation device. So we would want to have a charged species. So we need to have the plus one ions. And we want to maximize the formation of this plus one charged ions in the plasma. So that's our main focus when we are optimizing the plasma conditions or the sample introduction properties. And we can also minimize the amount of interferences by minimizing the amount of oxides and doubly charged ions that are also present in the plasma. But we don't want these. We don't want any oxides or doubly charged ions because they will cause spectral interference into our measurements. So we will optimize the plasma alignment and carrier gas flow so we can get rid of the oxides and doubly charged ions. Yeah. Then about the interface region. This is a picture of it. So when we come from the plasma, we have an ion beam, so plus one charged ions. If we are in a perfect world, we only have the plus one charged ions. This ion beam is directed to the interface. So here you can see the plasma. The sample is coming from here. And here we have some cones, which the sample travels through. And we are moving from normal air pressure of the plasma to vacuum. And we try to keep the composition and electrical properties of the ion beam as similar to the original as we can. So we don't want to change the composition or the electrical properties of the ion beam. And we are reducing the pressure here using these cones. So we are using 2 to 3 cones, and we are moving here to the vacuum. So here we have normal pressure. Here we are decreasing the pressure and moving to vacuum. And I have some cones for you to check out. These are old ones. What do the cones actually look like? This is, you can perhaps. Well, I don't know if it's very visible in the picture, but usually we have a bigger cone first and then a smaller cone and then a smaller cone. So the size of the cones decreases as you go into the vacuum. And they are sometimes called, here we have a sampler cone, which is the bigger one, and then a skimmer cone in the figure. I will actually show also to the recording. So these are the cones. I will let you take a look. Where do I have my? Here. Maybe you can see this is a sampler cone. So this is the first cone that the sample travels through. And this is a skimmer cone, which is after this bigger cone. So if the sample would, how to get them in the correct order? If the sample comes from here, you will have them in this order. Try to go back to my presentation. Yeah, we can take a look at these. These have seen some wear and tear, so they are a little bit retired, I would say, so these are not in use anymore. These are nickel cones. We can also use platinum cones, which are more expensive and they are more durable, but they are a lot more expensive. So we have used these nickel cones. And these cones have holes of about 0.4 to 1.2 millimeters inside or in the center where the sample travels through or the ion beam travels through. And then onto the ion optics. So when the sample has gone through the cones, it's in vacuum and we enter the ion optics. And the idea of the ion optics is to remove matrix components. And we will have some neutral atoms and particles, and these can dirty up your instrument. So we don't want them to ending up in our mass spectrometer. They can cause instability and increased cleaning requirements if these are not removed. Also photons, if you have photons ending up into the detector, you can get erased background signal and the detection limits can also increase because of this. So you need to get rid of neutral atoms, particles, photons when you're moving into the mass spectrometer. So the ion optics does this. There's two ways to do it, either an ion lens system or a quadruple is used. It depends on the manufacturer of the instrument, which technique they are using. This upper picture is of the ion lens system. It consists of metallic plates or cylinders which have a voltage. So let's take a look. The plasma is here. You can see the plasma and the cones are here. So the sample is traveling through and the ion optics is here and the beam is going through. But actually, here it's hitting a wall where the neutrons, photons, and particles are hitting a wall, and actually, our ion beam is deflected into a different path, so to speak. So, mass analyzer and mass separator is here. So, we are redirecting the ion beam to the mass analyzer so that we are getting rid of the matrix components. The quadruple ion deflector is used in Perkin-Elmer instruments. We have a Perkin-Elmer ICP-MS, so this is in our own instrument. It works in a similar way, but using a quadruple, so four metallic rods, which have a voltage applied to them, and the ion beam is again redirected 90 degrees, and the neutrons and photons go straight and are removed. So that's the idea of the ion optics. Then moving on to the mass separator. So now we have gotten rid of the matrix stuff. We are hopefully having an ion beam with plus one charged ions in it. And now we want to separate each ion from each other. And we use this mass to charge ratio. And when we are working with plus one ions, the Z is one. So it's actually the mass of the element that is where we can see the peak. And the most common technique to separate these masses from each other is the quadruple. And that's actually the same technique that was used to remove matrix interferences in the Perkin-Elmer instrument. So that it actually has two quadruples after each other. But this is separating the mass to charge ratio ions from each other. So we have four identical metal rods. So you can see them in the figure. One pair of rods is connected to a DC current and the other pair of rods is connected to a radio frequency, AC current, alternating currents. And this causes that only the ions with a certain mass to charge ratio can reach the detector from the center of the rods. And other ions, they have an unstable trajectory, or their path there is unstable, so they exit here between the rods, so they cannot access the detector. And these voltages are changed for each mass to charge ratio to analyze each element or each mass to charge ratio. And this is why the quadruple is a sequential analyzer, so it actually analyzes these masses after each other. So it changes the voltages, analyzes one, changes the voltages and analyzes one. But this is done in a very, very quick manner. So the scan rate of a quadruple is more than 5,000 atomic mass units per second. So it's very fast in scanning these, changing the voltages and scanning all of these mass to charge ratios. Yeah, so here you can see the ion flow coming in. We want to analyze, this is our analyte, let's say this black one, so plus one ion here. It's entering the quadruple and it's exiting through here to the detector, and the other interference species or other ions with the different mass to charge ratio, they are exiting through the gaps between the rods, so they exit, and only one mass to charge ratio ions are exiting from the detector at one time. Also, other options to separate the masses from each other is the time of flight mass separator or a magnetic sector analyzer. They can be also used for mass separation. Has someone been in Elina Kalenius mass spectrometer course? Have you done it? Yeah, you're probably familiar with the time of flight in that case. I think she talks about it in that course. But in ICBMS, the quadruple is very, very, very common. So very few instruments actually use this time of flight analyzer or this magnetic sector analyzer, because quadruple technology is quite inexpensive. I think that's the most important reason, because they are so inexpensive, so they are so commonly used. But time of flight, that's a really nice instrument because it's actually fully simultaneous separator. And this is because all of the ions come at the same time, they just fly in the fly tube different times. So that's basically the technique. But this allows some kind of interesting applications like multi-element analysis of single nanoparticles, which is not available using this quadruple technology. Then magnetic sector, it has a better resolution, peak resolution than the quadruple. I have a figure here showing it. So this is actually a typical interference that we are, very, very typical interference that we are seeing with the quadruple ICBMS mass per charge 56, which is the most abundant isotope of iron, and it's also happens to be where we can see argon oxide interference. So argon is the gas that we use to operate the plasma, and oxygen is of course always present, so we are seeing this argon oxide also at the same mass. So using a quadruple, these cannot be differentiated because they are so close in mass to each other. But with the magnetic sector separator, it's very, very high resolution. We can see the very small difference in the masses of these two species. We can separate these with the magnetic sector separator. So for interference removal, that's of course a superior technique, but the quadruple has different interference removal techniques we can also apply if we happen to find something like this. Okay, then moving on to the detector. From the mass analyzer, the ions arrive at the detector. We most commonly use an electron multiplier where the ions collide with dinodes that release electrons as a result of the collision. So here we have the quadruple rods. The ion is coming from here with the selected Empachet ratio, and its path is going to the first dinode. And as it moves from dinodes to new dinodes, it's releasing more and more electrons. So we are amplifying the signal, so to speak. And then we are able to move have an electronic signal. And this, if you're wondering why the ion path is that way, we have noise coming from the quadruple, so we are directing this noise to a different path. So we are not directing the noise to the dinode, but only the ion. So only the ion goes into our dinode, which is removing background, causing us to have better detection limits, because we are getting rid of this noise. Okay, then the measurement range. We can read this signal in both digital and analog modes. The digital mode gives the best sensitivity up to, I don't know how to say this in English. I will not try because it will go incorrect. It gives us best sensitivity in terms of counts per second. Here is the unit. And when you have more intense signals in like millions and so, you will use an analog mode to read the signals. This is just that we can have a wide linear range in the instrument when we use two different modes to read the signal. That's the only thing that's important here. Where's my title? I think my title has an animation that's not here. Oh no. Okay. I think the title should be like interferences or something. But okay, let's take a short break because this interferences stuff is quite heavy. So let's take a short break. And during the break, okay, how many? Okay, 10 past, we will continue. If you want to take a look at the torch, I have one torch here. I can show you how to dismantle it. So a short break. I will, maybe show it to the recording also. So I will try to get my laptop in a way that I can show the dismantling of the torch. But we will start again 10 past 11. Will stop the recording now and continue. No.
will try to show you where is my video. Oh, it's not my video show. It's probably showing, but I'm screen sharing, sorry, I'm not seeing myself. Okay, now. Screen sharing, but I need to screen share too. Well, I don't actually. I'm just thinking how to do this. If I wanted to show but you can see it when, because you can see my video now. It's recording my video. I don't need to screen share right now. Yeah. Hopefully the recording is taking this. I'm just going to show you guys. So this is an ICP OS plasma torch, and the sample is coming from here through the injector tube into the plasma, which is formed here inside the plasma torch. And I can take the injector out so you can see more clearly what the injector looks like. This is an aluminium oxide injector with an inner tube of 1.8 millimeters. So here is where the sample aerosol travels, carried by the carrier gas, which is argon. So the argon carrier gas is traveling through this injector, and it's carrying the sample aerosol with it, and so it's going into the plasma. Let's put it back again now. And here we have, you can see maybe the aluminium injector inside the plasma torch. So this is the plasma torch. It's made of quartz, and here the plasma is formed inside here, and this is a little bit dirty. This is a used one, so we can see the white spot here. Some sample has been dirtying up this quartz torch, and yeah, but it's still fine to use. They get really dirty quite easily, so we rarely see very clear torches, at least with our ICP instruments. Yeah. Here you can see a copper tape, which is for igniting the plasma. When you ignite the plasma, there is a metal clip or something, I don't know how to call it, a metal clip hitting this copper tape, and it gives the first spark, which forms the plasma. And then it's formed, and the sample travels through the injector into the plasma. If you take a closer look at the quartz torch, maybe you can see here, we have a slot here. So there is an opening inside the plasma torch here at the end of the torch, and this is for radial view. So if we analyze high concentrations, we can analyze using the radial view. So we view the plasma torch from the side or so from here. Then if we are measuring axial view, we are measuring from the end on, so like in this direction. So this is the axial view, which sees the most of the signal. It sees the signal the longest time, but then again, it's more there's more interference in this direction when you analyze here. And this slot is for the radial view. Then we are basically ready to start the lecture again. I will just share my screen again. I think my recordings will be super funny because I talk weird stuff here, but okay, bear with me. At least you will get some humor out of this. I'm wearing gloves because the quartz torch doesn't like when we touch it with bare hands. So, because our bare hands contain some sodium and so on, so we don't want that to end up in our quartz torch. So that's why I'm wearing gloves. I'm going to share my screen again. And I have the recording on. Then I will move on to the correct slide. Interferences in ICP-MS technique. Okay, I had the animation here incorrectly because my topic wasn't showing. I will try to get the title first. Okay. Then we can start again. Hopefully. It's not starting. It's showing on the big screen, but why it's not showing in my laptop. I will do it like this. I don't need to have my video showing. I will remove it. Now we can move.
Okay, then moving on to the heavy stuff of interferences. So matrix interferences are pretty much quite similar as in the ICP OH part, so I don't want to go through them here again. So you can see lecture two for information about the matrix interferences. There are some specifics regarding ICP-MS matrix interferences, but I have left them out. We will only go through the spectral interferences here because they are quite difficult in ICP-MS, but on the other hand, quite easy to correct. So when we have a spectral interferences, a component other than our analyte appears at the same Mpeg ratio, so mass per charge ratio. So this is what's happening when we have a spectral interference. And we have different kinds of spectral interferences. The first of all is isobaric interference. It's when we have two different elements and they have isotopes that have the same mass number. So that's happening, for instance, here with iron 58 and nickel 58. They have the same isotope. So what can you do? It's just how nature works. Then we have molecular or polyatomic interferences. They are charged compounds which appear in the spectrum as the sum of these elements' atomic mass numbers. So let's take an example. As I already saw the argon oxide interference, you can see argon has a mass of 40, oxygen has a mass of 16, and when you sum them up, you will get 56. And this interferes with the most abundant isotope of iron, which is 56 also. So in ICP-MS, you can have molecules entering the detector, and you can have these interferences. These interferences can originate from the sample itself or from reagents used in pretreatment. And hydrochloric is a very common interference causing acid if you have to use it during your sample pretreatment. And that is why we want to avoid it when we are analyzing samples with ICP-MS, because the chlorine causes so much polyatomic interferences. Another problem is our plasma gas, argon, that we cannot get rid of. We have to form the plasma using argon. So we have lots of argon species causing molecular interferences in ICP-MS. Another problem with spectral interferences is doubly charged species. So ions with a plus charge, plus two charge, appear in the spectrum with the half the Mpz value, or actually this is not actually correctly maybe said. So if you have the isotope mass and the charge is two, the Mpz value will then be divided by two. So it will appear in the spectrum with the half of the isotope mass. Actually, so I have to correct this into the slides.
Yeah.
That is why we always want to maximize the amount of plus one species in the plasma. So we are optimizing the plasma to get rid of the doubly charged, because they cause us a lot of problems and interferences. So that is why we are optimizing the plasma to maximize plus one charge ions. And for example of this doubly charged interference, we have barium plus two, which is the isotope mass is 138. And when it's plus two, you divide the isotope mass with two, you get 69, which happens to be gallium's isotope. So it will appear at the same as gallium plus one ion. I mentioned this already. So interferences from these molecular or doubly charged ions are minimized by optimizing the conditions. So we can do something about this. We can optimize the conditions, but if we still have interferences, as in many cases we do, even though we do optimization, the priority is to use an interference-free isotope. So if you have an element or analyte which has several isotopes, of course you would like to select an interference-free isotope, similar to ICP-OS, where you would just change the wavelength if you can. But it can be problematic. Sometimes the most abundant isotope, and so the most sensitive isotope, is interfered, and other isotopes that are available have very low natural abundance, which causes them to be very low in sensitivity. So if you have, let's say, one isotope that has 99% natural abundance and the other one has 1%, you can think about what is the sensitivity between those two peaks. And of course, this doesn't work when the analyte is monoisotopic, so only has one natural isotope. Mathematical correction is possible. You can use it for isobaric and molecular interferences. So if you have two elements overlapping, they have the same isotope, or then you would perhaps have the argon oxide or something like that. Okay, maybe not for argon oxide. Yeah, maybe that doesn't work for that. But we can use these formulas to calculate the portion of the interference and then subtract from our signal. So this is similar to actually ICP-OS. There was the one interference removal technique which was similar to this one. So there is a response of the interfering species is measured with another isotope, which of course needs to be interference-free. So we need to find an interference-free isotope for the interference. Okay, that sounded weird to my own audience, but maybe you understood it. So when we analyze the interference species with another isotope, we know how much of this interference we have, and then we can subtract it from our analyte signal or intensity. So this is how we get rid of some of our interferences. And we have an instrument software that actually automatically corrects for some of the known interferences. So it has some kind of equation after the isotope. Say, let's say I have an isotope X which I'm analyzing, and then I have a how will it go? I'm using an equation. I have would this is my analyte, X would be the analyte, and I would be Y would be my interference. So I would have the signal, I would subtract from the signal, let's say 0.38 would be my black response factor for the interference. So Y would be my interference here. So I would calculate this using a different, or analyze this interference using a different isotope, hoping that it would have a different isotope, and then subtract from my signal using the isotopic, natural isotopic abundances, because we know that which are the abundances for each element. Yeah, then there's another one. This is very widely used. We can use a collision or a reaction cell to get rid of our interferences. The ion beam is directed into a multipole. So, sorry, this is a translation issue. It should be octopole, hexapole, or quadrupole. Yeah, sorry, translation issue. To which a voltage is applied at radio frequency. So you can see here, this is our reaction or collision cell, and we put in an inert gas when we are using a collision cell, or a reactive gas when we are using a reaction cell. And then we are having some reactions happening during this cell. So it's located after the ion lens system, but before the analyzing quadrupole. So between the ion lens and the quadrupole system. And let's take a closer look. If we want to use this collision cell, this is also called kinetic energy discrimination, KID. The ion beam is directed at this collision cell, and it has inert gas inside it. So helium, for instance, hydrogen. And the analyte ions and molecular ions collide with the helium gas. Helium is the most commonly used. And more collisions occur with molecular ions due to their large surface area. Because they are bigger, bulky things, they bump into the helium ions more likely than the smaller analyte ions. You can see it here. The analyte is coming from the, or the ion beam is coming from the plasma. The collision gas is here, so we have small dots, black dots, which is the our gas. And our analyte is this yellow guy over here. And we have a polyatomic species, which is the interference species, which has the red atom in it and the blue atom in it. And you can see that when this yellow analyte is traveling through our collision cell, it's not as likely to collide with the helium gas compared to this interference, which is bigger, bulkier, and this will reach the detector. But as this interference species is bumping into the helium ions, is losing kinetic energy. So this is the kinetic energy discrimination. So it's losing kinetic energy and it cannot access the detector because this energy barrier here, it will have less energy and it cannot access the detector. That's what it means. Yeah, this works well for molecular interference removal, but if the doesn't work so well for isobaric, so if there are just single elements with the same isotope, with the same mass, it doesn't work because they are the same size. It needs to have a bulky guy to work this system. Then reaction cell. We can also put in a reactive gas. So we are doing some kind of reactions with our interference or our analyte. So either the analyte signal or the interference signal is moved to another mass to charge ratio or value. So we are moving one of those to get rid of the interference. For example, if we use hydrochloric acid in our, let's say, sample pretreatment procedure, we are causing a molecular interference of this chlorine and oxygen. So 35 plus 16, we are causing an interference on 51 vanadium mass. How do we get rid of this problem? Well, you could also use kinetic energy discrimination because this is molecular species. You could get rid of it using that way. But this is an example how to get rid of it using a reaction gas. So here the chlorine species is reacting with ammonia. So ammonia is a commonly used reaction gas. We actually have it in our system. Also, oxygen is another option. Commonly used, so we are forming a neutral species, this chlorine oxygen here, and this is an exothermic reaction, so it's happening in the reaction cell. But vanadium doesn't react with ammonia since the similar reaction would actually be endothermic, so it's not happening in the reaction cell. And only this 51 vanadium plus one peak is left in the mass spectrum since this neutral compound is remaining in the reaction cell because it's neutral and it's not anymore in ionic state, so it's not traveling to the mass, to the detector. So here we move the interference to actually not a different mass because we get rid of it completely, but we got rid of the interference from the analyte spectrum. But alternatively, we can use oxygen as the reaction gas here, so we can actually react the vanadium with oxygen, forming a vanadium oxide here using a different mass. So we react the analyte with oxygen to get a different species that we actually measure. So now we are moving the analyte to a mass of 67. So 51 plus 16 is 67. So So the analyte is moved to a different mass. And this, of course, doesn't have this chlorine interference, the new mass. Summary. Okay. So let's take a look what you should maybe take from this lecture. Lots of theory, new stuff to you. So maybe come back to it later. But what you should maybe try to remember at least that the sample introduction and the plasma, we are for trying to form a plus one charged species, and we are optimizing the plasma and sample introduction in a way that we only want plus one. The interface transfers the ion beam to vacuum from the normal temperature or normal temperature, normal pressure of the plasma. Ion optics removes the neutral species and the photons. Mass separator separates the ions according to their mass to charge ratio, and quadrupole is the most common technique. Detector amplifies and counts the signals. Then interference removal, try to use other isotopes, mathematical correction, and then using collision or reaction cell if everything other fails. But there are lots of options for interference removal in ICP-MS and lots of reaction gas that could be used. You just need to know which is the reaction that would happen in the plasma or in the reaction cell. So it requires some chemical knowledge also. And that is why when we started the course, I mentioned that method development for ICP-MS requires more expertise. And maybe now you understand why. Because of the reactions, if you need some kind of interference removal, you will need some knowledge on which reactions could happen in this reaction cell and which kind of gases to use. To be honest, I've been operating ICP-MS and we haven't used reaction cell. But in many cases they use, and it's very, very useful. But we usually use only this kinetic energy discrimination, so helium mode. That's what we commonly use. Okay. That's it for today. Thursday we have some exercises again that we are going to calculate, focusing on ICP-MS this time. And yeah, I will try to get the group work stuff into Moodle as soon as possible. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Please go ahead if you have. I'm going to stop the recording also. Thank you for watching.